Blog Talk Radio.
TJB Radio. Intriguing programs you want, information you need.
With those lovely musical strains, and it was a strain to hear it, this is Jeff Bushman. It's the Jeff Bushman Experience, so all of that fits together. Welcome to our program. It is live on March the 29th, 2015. Was it obvious I had forgotten to look to see what the date was? But it is March 29th, 2015. March will soon be gone, and April will be upon us. We are broadcasting to you from the lovely state of Arizona in the Phoenix metropolitan area, where the high today will be 98, which I mentioned for those of you who are still looking at snow on the ground. Summertime in the Phoenix area does tend to get warm, although it's warmer earlier than it usually is. And we'll actually be talking about that, sort of, in the sense of discussing Ted Cruz, but Jerry Brown. But we'll get to that in just a minute. The trivia question for the day, and we'll come back to it, and it really only applies if you have been a listener to the program over, say, the last month or so at least, because the question is, what is the title of our closing theme? Okay, and we will give you the answer on that in just a few minutes, but the question again, what is the title of the closing theme to the program, which will in fact occur about 27 and a half minutes from now. So welcome to the show. Stay with us for the half hour. We're going to be talking about several topics, not exactly the topics we had advertised last week because things change. And what we're going to be talking about today is one of those things, which is I was wrong. Yes, really. And we're going to be talking about Jerry Brown, as mentioned. We're going to be talking about Ted Cruz. We're going to be talking about taxes. And if there's still time after that in this rather short half hour, we're going to be talking about the First Amendment and how it relates to the Confederate flag on license plates. So stay with us. But first, we have one message from bushmanbooks.blogspot.com. If you haven't visited there, please do that when you get an opportunity. You'll see trivia questions, some silly writing from me, and if you are inclined to buy something or at least shop for something on Amazon, you can use the banner ad of Amazon's right there, and should you end up buying something, they'll give us a few pennies out of your dollars, and it won't cost you any extra. So it's a way of supporting the show is by going to bushmanbooks.blogspot.com, and while you're there, if you're so inclined to take a look at any of the books we've written, there is a way of accessing them right from there. Don't have to buy, just if you'd like to look and determine whether you'd like to buy our magnificent books or our semi-magnificent books, feel free to do that. Let's get into it. I was wrong. How was I wrong? Well, I had said last week and the week before that I expected that Netanyahu, in the initial case, I said I thought he would get more votes than anybody else, that is, more seats for his party in the Israeli parliament. I was right about that, but what I was wrong about was I said, at looking at the numbers that each of the parties had obtained, I expected there to be what is called a government of national unity, where the two largest parties got together, traded off the prime ministership, and so on and so forth. And I now have egg on my face, which is really good for my complexion, but that's another story. Anyway, I have egg on my face because very clearly he has been able to form a coalition of parties that does not include the second greatest number of votes for a party. That is the so-called Zionist Union, which is really a species of the Labor Party. So Netanyahu's Likud bloc will be the largest party in the parliament, called the Knesset, and there are a bunch of other parties, including extreme religious parties. The good part of all this is that in Israel, the extreme religious parties are neither Muslim nor Christian. So at least it won't be that much of a nutcase government, but they're plenty nutty on their own. Okay. Jerry Brown was the youngest governor that California ever had. Okay, now I grew up in California, so I know a little of his history. Let me tell you a little of that because it's interesting. Jerry Brown was the youngest governor that California ever had. He was assisted to some degree by the fact that his father was governor of California before him, not immediately before him, but was governor of California a number of years before that. I actually shook Pat Brown, that's Jerry Brown's father, I actually shook Pat Brown's hand in 1964. I was very young at the time. And he was on a the back of a truck or something. He was up on a stage on the street where a bunch of us went to visit because in addition to Pat Brown, Hubert Humphrey was there. He was running for vice president, which will give you an idea of the timing. And of course, Humphrey won what might be called a Pyrrhic victory, but he did become vice president. And Pat Brown was Jerry Brown's father. Jerry Brown, before he became governor the first time, was a member of the Junior College Board of Trustees in the area, then the Secretary of State, and then became governor. And he was governor for a couple of terms, and different people have different views about what kind of job he did. I think he did okay. And now he is the oldest governor that California has ever had, which is rather obviously unusual and not likely to be repeated anytime soon. But as I said, he was the youngest, he's now the oldest, and last week he was on Meet the Press. If you get a chance to get a podcast of that program, you should do it, because he talks about the drought in California, climate change, and a number of other things. For a while now, Bill Maher on his HBO program has been suggesting that Jerry Brown would make a very good president of the United States, yes, even though he is now 76 years old. He is a lot sharper than a lot of younger people and would be a really interesting candidate, even if he didn't win the nomination, and I think he would. Even if he didn't win the nomination, be a very interesting candidate, would really shake up the debate. And he says he's not going to do it because he's too old. I don't agree. And part of that may be because as time goes by, I get closer and closer to his age. But I guess we all do, don't we? In any event, he is just really sharp and really has a very good grasp of the issues. If you get a chance to listen, as I say, to that Meet the Press interview or download anything else that Jerry Brown might have been involved with that might be on YouTube, really a good idea. It would educate you, inform you, and perhaps make you a fan. And on that Meet the Press interview, one of the people who was a guest was a former congresswoman from California who was saying how great he is, for what it's worth. Obviously, that's her opinion. You might not agree with it. One of the things Jerry Brown did say, however, that's worth mentioning, is Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz has since declared for the presidency that he's going to run. Among a number of people, I should say, believe that he's actually really running for the vice presidential nomination. I'm not sure of that. But I guarantee you, loves the attention that he's been getting since he announced that he was running for president. Jerry Brown said about Ted Cruz that Cruz has forfeited his right to run for office. He didn't mean in a legal sense. Although he is Canadian, but that's a whole other story. But he said he forfeited his right to be considered for public office, any public office, let alone president, because he has essentially ignored what well over 90% of climate scientists say with regard to climate change. That is, it's obviously happening. A very large percentage of those say it's caused by humans, but that's a different question. Cruz denies that climate change even exists, because after all, it was snowing in New Hampshire last week. Okay. Ted Cruz, if he believes what he says, and I frankly doubt that he believes everything he says, but if he believes what he says, it just demonstrates that certain elements of the Republican right aren't just ill-informed, they're bloody crazy. Okay, and Ted Cruz fits that bill, not just by what he says about climate change. By the way, one of the arguments that a lot of conservatives make, why climate change became a partisan issue, I don't know. It's really science. It's like gravity becoming a partisan issue. But apparently a lot of conservatives say, well, I'm no scientist, and besides that, many scientists say that climate change isn't real. Well, some scientists do, but if a scientist who is studying bacteria and antibiotic resistance says to me that climate change is not real, I might find it interesting that he bothered to issue an opinion. I find it crazy that anybody would bother to consider it. If you look at climate scientists, it's well over 90% who indicate that climate change is real. And again, most of those say that humans have caused it. I don't care who causes it. I just suggest we might want to do something about it because we don't have any other planet we can go to. Okay. But the other thing that Ted Cruz has said, and said Monday when he made the announcement, which is what I want to concentrate on next, is he said he wants to abolish the IRS. Okay. Now that, I've got to tell you, that sounds crazy too, and it mostly is. And I don't want to abolish the IRS, and I'm sure most of you, although you may not like the IRS, realize that there has to be some mechanism for the federal government to collect revenue in order to run the government. You may not think that everything the government does is good, and I would agree with you, although we might disagree on which specific thing they do that's a waste of time and money. But we all agree that the federal government has to at least do some things, and for that they need revenue. Okay. And Ted Cruz wants to abolish the IRS. I don't want to abolish the IRS, but I would like to make it smaller. And depending on how much time we have, we'll talk about how to do that and how to still have a reasonable, intelligent, okay, we don't have that now, but a reasonable, intelligent taxation system that causes everybody to pay their fair share among those who pay anything at all. And that basically is what we'll talk about, but I want to give you an opportunity to chime in if you're so inclined. If you are, you can call us at 347-850-8702. I'm well aware that most people who listen to this broadcast do it in podcast form, and therefore you can't call in, obviously, if it's a recording. But I want to invite you to express your opinion another way if you'd like. You can email us at T as in Tom, J as in Jeff, B as in Bushman, TJB radio at gmail.com. If you'd care to email us and express an opinion, I will read the letters on air next time or the time after, depending on when you send it in. And it doesn't matter to me whether it's sensible or idiotic. And frankly, if you want to make your letter idiotic, it'll be funnier. But if you want to make it sensible, then we can at least have a sensible discussion about it. In any event, when we come to taxes, we have the best tax system possible if it worked. Okay? And the reason I say that is because, besides the fact that it doesn't, the reason it doesn't work and why it would be a good, fair system if it did is this. We have what's called a progressive tax system. And in a progressive tax system, what it means is not just if you make more, you pay more. Every tax system you can name is designed to do that. Even a regular sales tax. If I am going to go spend $10, I'm going to spend less in sales tax than you are if you go spend $20. Okay. But the progressive income tax is different in the sense that if I'm making, pick a number, $50,000 a year, and you're making $300,000 a year, you're not going to, if, again, assuming fairness and no deductions and no idiocy, all of the things being equal, you won't just pay six times as much tax as I do because 300,000 is six times more than 50, you'll pay something like eight times more or nine times more or 12 times more because as your income goes up, your percentage of tax goes up as well. Now, to people who are making a lot of money or who have been stymied by Republican propaganda, that doesn't seem fair. Why don't we all pay the same percentage and then the people who make the $300,000 or $1 million will pay commensurately more, and that's fair. Well, the design of a progressive income tax, and people like to say this word as if it's dirty, and it isn't. The goal, or one of the goals, of a progressive income tax is redistribution of wealth. Okay, you may not like that, or you may like it. But if you think that it's appropriate that someone who makes $300,000 a year should pay more in income taxes on a percentage basis than someone who makes $50,000 a year. That's the current American tax system. The problem with the current American tax system is what I alluded to before. It doesn't work. What happens is once you make a certain level of money, you have the opportunity to take advantage of deductions from your taxes that people who make less money don't have the opportunity to do. So you may pay, theoretically, you may pay the same amount of dollars to take care of your shelter needs, but, in other words, your house or your apartment or whatever, as I do, who makes less, but what happens is you are able to start deducting things from your taxes I can't do, first because you have an accountant you can afford that I can't, and secondly, because that accountant is going to be able to find deductions for you that H&R Block won't find for me. Okay, so the system doesn't work. So what do we do? Well, there are all kinds of possibilities. All right. One is, of course, you eliminate taxes but raise tariffs. That was the original way we raised revenue in this country, is that we charged a tariff, which is an import fee, on imported products, and that paid really all the needs of government. But the needs of government were a lot less then, and our expectations were a lot less. And some people might say, well, that's okay, let's go back to that. But the truth of the matter is tariffs would have to be so outrageous that it would have a number of negative consequences. For one, if you wanted to buy what is now, say, a $20,000 Toyota, it would have to cost you about $50,000. Additionally, the other effect of high tariffs is it gives an unfair advantage to domestic products. And when I say unfair, I don't mean to say that there's never a good idea to favor domestic products. But what you end up doing is the situation we had back in the 70s, where tariffs were so high and therefore imports were so much more expensive that American manufacturers didn't have to do anything to sell their products. So they ended up making a lot of lousy products, and people didn't have any choice. If you wanted a car, you could buy GM, Chrysler, or Ford, unless you had a lot of money for a very small car, where you could buy a Toyota or a Nissan, then called Datsun, and that's what you could do. So tariffs, in addition to not producing enough money, also have the disadvantage of skewing the economy sufficiently in favor of domestic products that domestic manufacturers produce bad products or less quality products. So that's one. The other thing you could do is there's been a lot of attention given recently to what's called the flat tax. Pick a number, let's say 15%. All of us pay 15% on our incomes, regardless of source, no deductions, flat. Very simple. You can put the expression they use is you could put your tax return on a postcard. And while true, it ignores a couple of things. Let's say we made a 15% tax, and you applied that to someone who's earning $50,000 and someone who's earning $500,000. Okay? At $50,000, that's going to be a $7,500 tax, which is going to leave somebody at $50,000 with $42,500. That sounds like it's not that terrible, but that's really not very much money, especially in some of our larger cities like New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, D.C. That's tough it's tough to make a living, period, in those cities. But when you are talking about a 15% flat tax, you're still left with $42,500. That's not very much. Counter that with the person who's making $500,000 a year. There aren't that many of them, but there are some. So that same person pays that 15%, that's $75,000. That's an enormous tax chunk. It's more than my $50,000 income, if that's what I was earning, right? That's a bunch of money. But that person still has $425,000 that year. They could probably squeak by, would be my guess. So and this is not about confiscatory taxes. It's not about class warfare. The reality is that a flat tax definitely favors the wealthy, even more than our current progressive income tax does, because they have a lot more money and left over after that flat tax is paid. So there needs to be some level of progressivity, and we then get to what some have come to call the fair tax. And the fair tax, simply put, is you eliminate the income tax. No more income tax. Bye-bye. Okay? And what you have instead is a sales tax. Now, if you just did that, it would be very regressive. Same kind of reasoning. Poor and middle-class people, whatever, have to buy certain things every week or every month. We always have to pay our rent. Everybody pays rent. Everybody has to buy certain levels of food. Everybody has to have a certain level of transportation. And let's assume just for chuckles we applied the same 15% number. But that would be all your sales tax. All of your federal sales tax would be 15%. You would pay no income tax. There are ways to overcome that regressivity, and if there's time, we'll cover it today, if not next week. But the fact is that if we did that, and let's assume that a person earning $50,000 a year might spend, I don't know real numbers, let's say they spend 30% of their income. If they spend 30% of their income, and they're more likely actually to spend a higher percentage, but let's just say that, 30% of $50,000 is 15 grand. If they paid 15% on $15,000, I get lost in the math, very frankly. That would be about $2,250 a year. So the odds are pretty good that it would actually be higher because they would spend a higher percentage of their income. But that same situation, if you have the person who's earning $500,000 a year spend 15% of her or his income, you now have $75,000 spent. Okay, $75,000 spent, and you put 15% on that, that's something like $11,000 in taxes, obviously a great deal more. And what makes that more interesting on one level, if you're into this sort of thing, and by now I'm probably interesting only about 7 people who are listening to this. Actually, that's double our normal listenership. Anyway, but what really makes that interesting is this. Poor people, middle-class people, spend a higher percentage of their income than rich people do. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is you can only find so many things to spend your money on. But the other one is that when you're talking about someone at the lower level of the economy, they have a lot of very important holes to fill. A larger percentage of their income, of course, goes for food. Okay, I don't care if you're buying caviar. If you're earning $500,000 a year, there's only so much a year you can spend on food. I mean, I'm sure you could really Mickey Mouse the numbers and come up with something, but typically they spend a smaller percentage of their income on food. Same with transportation, same with everything. So one of the problems with tax breaks for people who are well off, as contrasted with tax breaks for people who are poor in the current system, is that tax breaks for the poor and middle class get put into the economy much faster because they spend a greater percentage of their income. Tax breaks for the wealthy are terrific for the wealthy, but the truth is they spend a relatively small portion of it. A lot of that is going to be saved. Nothing wrong with saving money. Money being saved puts capital into the economy as well, but not as much and not as fast. Getting back to the so-called fair tax, if you did something like that, then even though the wealthy are spending a smaller percentage of their income than poor people do and middle-class people do, they would still be contributing, obviously, a large amount of money into the economy and into the government. But probably no greater than they're spending now, and perhaps a little greater, and that's okay because they're rich. It's all right. But here's the other things that happen with a fair tax, the sales tax instead of the income tax. By the way, when I have talked to people about doing something like this, the thing they always say is, but that would mean that the sales tax would be really high. And the answer is, yeah, probably that's true. But there'd be no income tax. If you pay tax on your earned income and you have no tax, you have all that extra money or additional money, I hate to call it extra, all that additional money to spend in a way that you deem appropriate. You're going to pay a tax on it. It's going to be a relatively high tax, but you're still going to be better off because you're not paying income tax. You're getting all your money, except for Social Security. You're getting all the money you earn to spend as you deem appropriate. Okay, so it's even with a high sales tax, it won't hurt that much. And if you're in a position where you have what's called discretionary income, that is, you don't need to spend every penny you get, then you get to choose to some extent how much tax you pay. For example, if you have a certain level of discretionary income and you have a choice between a new car and a used car, well, the used car, because it costs less, you're going to pay much less tax. So there is a choice to be made. Same thing if you want to buy a boat or whatever it is. Whatever you want to spend in terms of discretionary income, it's called discretionary because you've got the discretion. You can make a choice. Okay. The other thing is we need to talk about eliminating the regressivity of a sales tax. How do you do that? Well, there's a couple of ways. One of the things you can do is say, all right, if you live in Arizona, which is a relatively low-cost state, by the way, you live in Arizona and you're paying rent or a mortgage payment, I'll tell you what, the first $800, pick a different number if you like a different number, the first $800 you don't have to pay any sales tax on. For all other goods, you know, and for food, certain foods, up to a certain level of food, or if you have an income that's lower than X, whatever X is established to be, you don't pay any sales tax on your food. You get a card that exempts you from sales tax when you go to the supermarket and buy food. Okay? That eliminates limits the regressivity, the unfairness to people who have less money because they can still get all their food, they can still pay a reasonable rent. And by the way, in Washington, D.C., you might have to make that number for rent. I don't know because I don't live there and I don't know what rents go for there. But say it's the appropriate amount would be $1,800. Whatever the amount is, there are people who know more than I do about what's the average normal rent in the situation where someone is not living luxuriously but is living normally and what they have to pay for rent. That should be exempt from the sales tax that you would pay on all these other things, again, except for food. If your income is low enough, the food and the rental, and by the way, rent could be a mortgage payment too, would eliminate a lot of the taxes that people would pay who have relatively little money, and then they would only pay taxes on things like things we may want to spend money on but don't have to. The rest of us, those who have more money, would in fact spend. Would pay taxes on our food and on our rent or mortgage payment, but poor people, or not poor people, let me try that again. The rest of us would pay taxes on our food, but only poor people would not pay taxes on their rent or mortgage payment, and poor defined as some level of X number of times the poverty level. That's it. You then pay sales tax on everything else. You would certainly create a lot of income for government. You could make the law revenue neutral, and you could have the Congress pass each year what the percentage is that is going to be applied to the federal sales tax. So this year it might be 15%, but if that raises a surplus of money, next year you might make it 13. And if that raises an insufficient amount of money, the next year you make it 17, and so forth. You can do all kinds of things with that based on what's happened with the revenue creation. Another thing this tax would do is it would eliminate the hidden economy, okay? Prostitutes don't pay income taxes. Drug dealers don't pay income taxes, probably. Or at least they don't pay taxes on their drug income if they may be doing something else. But they all buy things. Everybody buys things. Same thing with all of the hidden income in terms of organized crime. If you had a relatively high sales tax and no income tax, you would bring in a lot of revenue that way. Next week, please join us. We're going to be talking about, and I'm sorry to cut that short, and because there's certainly a whole lot more to say, but we are running out of time. So next week you can join us. The current plan is to talk about the Bill of Rights and specifically the First Amendment and the Confederate flag, and I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot of other things. By the way, the answer to the trivia question is Tchaikovsky's Kazoo Concerto No. 1. And we're going to play that now. Please join us next week. Same bat time, same bat station. Till then, be kind to each other, and please don't go away mad.